This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by ASP Consensus member Major General Paul Eaton, U.S. Army retired, who's currently Managing Director of the Vets Voice Foundation, and served in a variety of very interesting and exciting posts, which we will talk about, which include CMAT in Iraq, which now has another acronym, Coalition for Military Training Team. Was also the Chief Infantry Officer for the Army and Chief Operations Officer in Somalia. General Eaton, thanks for joining us.
Maggie, great to have me. Thank you very much.
So you are, of course, as I said, a member of ASP's Consensus and a retired flag officer who is known for being, let's say, out there on a lot of issues, which is great. And a lot of people know you more on climate and energy security, but that's not what we're going to talk about today. I think let's start with Iraq. So you had a key role, right? Before Petraeus, there was you. What was that like?
Well, I had just gotten back to Fort Benning after being away for a while, and my wife took me to see this the Chattahoochee River in full flood stage. And en route, I got a phone call from my four-star boss, and he says, and this is how it goes, Paul, the chief of staff of the Army has selected you to go to Iraq to rebuild the Iraqi armed forces. And my wife says, well, what was that? And I said, this is the new mission that I got. And it was May 9. It was Mother's Day in 2003. Oh. And my wife, who is a Marine's daughter, said, you know, I would have thought that guy would have been there already. So we started late. It was rushed. I had to close up shop at Fort Benning. And I reported to Iraq with essentially a white sheet of paper, $170 million, and six borrowed staff members from the CENTCOM staff. Oh. And we sat down with this white sheet of paper and designed the Iraqi Army, Air Force, Navy in rough terms, basing structure. It was an exciting mission, and my chain of command in Iraq was essentially Walt Slocum, who had the ministry development job, Ministry of Defense, and Ambassador Bremer,
sure,
going to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. That was my chain of command. And we'll talk a little bit more later about how that was a bit of a challenge to me.
Yeah. So you sit down with six people and a white sheet of paper, and you draw out this plan. Did you stick to the plan?
No. The plan started as, you know, no plan survives first contact.
Sure.
And so I was directed, because we didn't have enough military personnel to use military to train Iraqi armed forces.
Okay.
I had to go a contract route. So
interesting.
I went back to Fort Benning electronically and asked them to do the contract work, which they were not obliged to do. They simply did the right thing, helped me greatly. The Vanel Corporation won the contract to train. They were extraordinary in their ability to produce a team of about 150 men to come to Iraq under very austere conditions to begin training the Iraqi armed forces. And in fact, the way we started was Iraqi Army Infantry. That was it. Narrow focus.
Gotcha.
So the plan was to recruit 1,000 people, 1,000 young Iraqis, and to train them into one infantry battalion, assuming attrition would develop an infantry battalion of about 750. It did not go well.
Oh.
The soldiers train soldiers. Even if your contracted trainer soldiers or trainers are prior military, they are not seen as such by soldiers going through the training.
Sure.
So the best people to train, basic trainees, are soldiers of that country. It can be done with soldiers from other countries a little bit more difficult. You have any number of cultural, linguistic frictions to be applied. But we decided that we needed another approach. And we had a model in the American Army called the cohort model, where you would start with a cadre of soldiers of the required ranks for a particular unit, give them basically trained soldiers, and then they would finish the collective training to create a rifle battalion. I went through that, actually, as a battalion commander. So that's the model that I wanted.
Sure.
And I had an opportunity on 5 September 2003 to brief that model to Secretary Rumsfeld. And he approved that. He also approved a bump up to $2.2 billion to do the project.
So that's more than $170
million. Yes, it is. And what we were able to do with that $2.2 billion was develop the infrastructure for three divisions. Because the military infrastructure in Iraq had been destroyed.
Right.
There was nothing. If you found a tank, it was useless because all the copper wiring had been stripped out. Anything of value had been stripped out. The engine's gone. So literally, we had to start from the very basic level.
Wow.
And that model agreement that we had with the Secretary of Defense allowed us to immediately bring in some other components. I wanted the Jordanian army to prepare my officers. We drew officers from Iraq's former army and sent them to Jordan to be to expose them to what I believe to be the finest Arab army we can find. And the Jordanians were magnificent in their ability to do that. I converted the Vanel Corporation contract team to a non-commissioned officers academy. So they were now providing instruction, not soldierization, but instruction to the Iraqi non-commissioned officer corps. That academy we set up in Iraq. We then developed cadres of the Jordanian-trained officers, re-blued officers, if you will, with the non-commissioned officers. We built battalion cadres, gave them 1,000 young Iraqi recruits, and with the oversight of coalition assistant training teams, with Americans and various other nationalities, the British, the Australians assisted, and those 10-man teams would provide assistance to the man, train, equip of infantry battalions, and that model I was able to hand off to General Petraeus in June of 2004, and that's the model that that he executed for that future year.
So what were your kind of goals with this model? What were you hoping at the end of your command, went before you turned it over to the next person, who, of course, like you said, ended up being General Petraeus. What was your definition of success?
The definition of success was 9 infantry battalions. I got to 7, and it took us a little while to ramp up some of the preparation in Jordan and my non-commissioned officers academy. The intent was 9 Iraqi infantry battalions, man trained and equipped by Iraqi officers and non-commissioned officers, yet also exposed to the Western Army ethos on civilian control of the military, how officers treat non-commissioned officers and privates, and an infantry battalion, 9 infantry battalions, that we could consider to be allies, and that we would be happy to have on our left or right in a combat situation.
Sure. So you said allies. Important word, generally speaking, but also kind of in the story of Iraq. How difficult was that to build an allied relationship with Iraqi non-commissioned officers, officers and privates, and what little was left of civil society at that time?
I had an incident at the very beginning when I asked the American division commanders to send me 10 or 15 former Iraqi Army lieutenant colonels and majors. And I got about 45. They arrived by bus to my training base in Kirkush, different from Kirkuk.
Kirk. Okay.
And Kirkush is about 90 kilometers out in the middle of nowhere near the from Baghdad, near the Iran-Iraq border.
Mm-hmm.
And they arrived. I gave them the briefing, and my senior vanilla trainer, retired Lieutenant General George Crocker, who is a bit of a hero in the American Army and a member of the class of 66. So a little bit of an irony with active duty Major General Paul Eaton working with retired Lieutenant General George Crocker. You don't forget the man's rank, even if he is retired.
Right, absolutely. Yes.
And he was invaluable to the whole program. He came back to me and said, we have some problems. They have demands. First demand, they want more money. Second demand, they want their old ranks back. And the third demand, they weren't going to work with the coalition.
Well, that doesn't sound like it's going to work.
So we put them on the bus and sent them back to Baghdad. And so we go from that, and understanding Tom Friedman in one of his lectures or one of his op-eds said, the Iraqis are burdened with some 1,600 years of Islamic State and 30-plus years of Saddam despotism.
Right.
The easiest thing to develop in an American soldier is what the British call the moral component.
Mm-hmm.
You develop a soldier physically, you give him training, and then you work on the moral component. And for an American, it is so easy because they come to us and they believe in all of the national institutions. They
Right.
believe in the Constitution of the United States. They understand how U.S. government work. They understand civilian control of the military. They believe in their chain of command. They believe their chain of command will not let them
down, right.
fail or let them down. That was the hardest thing to develop for young Iraqis, that their chain of command would not let them down. And we saw this terrific failure after the very good Iraqi chain of command
right.
that we developed over time. After we left in 2011, we saw the Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki decimate the Iraqi military chain of command in favor of people who were more loyal
right.
than good. And all the work that we had done to develop the Iraqi armed forces, that we were not going to leave a man, that we were not going to fail to resupply,
right.
all of that crashed. And that is a principal component of the failure that they had because of the prime minister. And I understand cultural challenges, but we had a great army going into
right.
2011, and conditions
changed
from outside changed and created this terrible dilemma that happened over 2012 and 13.
So before we look at kind of 2011 and post 2011, you mentioned at the start, of course, chain of command, your own challenges with chain of command, or the challenges that arose because the chain of command you were dealing with was different than what's standard. So what was different about the chain of command you were experiencing, and what kind of challenges did that create?
The biggest challenge with the chain of command that I had for all of the time that I was there, from June of 03 to June of 04, mm-hmm. I did not have a four-star general in my chain of command who had had a Secretary of Defense finger put in his chest to tell him that I was his guy to make succeed.
Yeah.
All of my communications were two-star Eaton going into the joint staff, trying to unlock monies that were in my account, and I was dealing VFR direct from the field past CENTCOM. CENTCOM was not in my chain of command.
That's so interesting.
And General Sanchez, who commanded CJTF-7, was not in my chain of command. Rick Sanchez did everything he could to provide for things that I need that I could not get by contracting to back to the United States or other places. So that failure, and there is nothing like a four-star general to unlock resources and to make the Pentagon do your bidding.
Yeah.
And I did not have that. And and I'm not whining because I'm a two-star out there.
Oh, no.
But, you know, the two-star needs a four-star who's going to run interference for him with all the things that happened. And that was the single greatest problem that we had. Mm-hmm. And my team performed brilliantly.
Right.
And people did wonderful, wonderful work for us when they were not
obligated,
required
yeah.
to do so. And so the big learning point is just make sure you got a four-star somewhere in the chain of command and that he knows you and loves you mm-hmm. and wants you to succeed.
That sounds like generally good life advice.
I think it is.
Probably harder to execute outside of the military, though. So looking at the state of Iraq now and the de-evolution from 2011, one thing that we hear sometimes is this question, is Iraq a failed state? Is it on its way to a failed state? And for you, as you know, we talked about before we started recording our interview, your first experience with hostile fire was in Somalia, which is almost across the board recognized as a failed state. I don't know how I feel about that personally, but that's a different podcast. So your experience in Somalia and looking at the state of Iraq now, do you think it's a fair comparison, or is it really more of a warning?
I would not use it as a it's all things can be compared and lessons learned from
sure.
them. So more warning than a comparison. Somalia, immediately visible as a failed state. I mean, the infrastructure was
right.
very seriously damaged. The only leadership that they had before we came in was the warlords.
Right.
And so you had an exhausted, failed state when the United States and its allies came into Somalia. They were so tired that they said, "We're glad you're here. The principal mission that we had was to move goods and services into the hinterland to the people who needed them. Get food to those who needed it. Get water to those who needed
right.
it. And ensure that the warlords did not get in there to frustrate that."
Right.
To my knowledge, we didn't have to kill anybody the five months. I came in on the first wave. To my knowledge, we lost no soldiers in that first 5 months. And it is only when we started pushing hard against the warlords that we started to take casualties. And I believe the Pakistanis were the first to suffer greatly from a firefight. And then, of course, we had Black Hawk Down.
Right.
But definitely a failed state. All their political institutions had completely crumbled, and it was a slow effort to try to rebuild that, to try to find sensible forces to rebuild. In Iraq, Secretary Rumsfeld's comment when Baghdad was taken and then completely fell apart. One of the assumptions going into this was that we would immediately turn over control to the existing government and that the police forces and all the political infrastructure would remain intact. In military planning, if you have an important assumption,
that's not good.
You have to back that up with a contingency.
Sure.
So a contingency plan to address a failed assumption. Rumsfeld refused to allow Tommy Franks, the commanding general of CENTCOM, to plan for phase four, the reconstruction phase. That set the stage for the anarchy that developed very quickly, and the United States immediately had to take on all the political infrastructure of Iraq. Painstakingly built over the first year, and tremendous challenges with all the conflicting ethnicities and religion issues. And so we gradually arrive at a reasonable government and a government that was wary of American presence until we left. And then al-Maliki took it down a dark path and did his best to destroy the political infrastructure that had been developed. We're back with men and women on the ground. I don't like the term boots on the ground, but we have men and women on the ground. And we continue to work very closely with the al-Abadi government to ensure that we can do all we can to help the political infrastructure mature and manage the challenges, the great challenges that that Iraq has. So it's a state in gestation, and I have faith in Iraq. I trust absolutely in the Kurds, and they are a very significant positive influence to ensure that the Shia and the Sunni will move forward. And so it's the Iraq is a very educated society, a very high literacy rate, in excess of 80% for men, 70% for women. I am an optimist.
Well, then I think it's probably appropriate for our last question, right, which is always, of course, what's next? When you look at where Iraq is now, with that hope and optimism, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, what do you think it will look like? What do you hope it will look like? And if we go the right way or the wrong way, what does that mean for the rest of the world? It's a big question, I know.
Europe went through a very bad war, the 30 Years' War, trying to resolve the religious conflicts that were introduced into a very complex society. The Arab Spring kicked off, I believe, and I am not a great scholar, but I lived what I saw.
Right.
And the Arab Spring kicked off a process that is unraveling, unfolding in front of us right now. And we are witnessing at once states trying to work their national interests in the region, Saudi Arabia and Iran and Yemen and Kuwait and all these states. Mm-hmm. Syria and Iraq are in the crucible. But these relationships that were always of concern are now going through a very aggressive resolution. And I don't think it's going to happen quickly, but it has to go through this process. And the national interests of the significant powers in the region, and Iran and Saudi Arabia are very significant powers in the region. Turkey must be brought into the solution. All of this very conflicted area of operations right now is going through a process that has to unfold. And whatever the West can do to contain the violence and to support a rational outcome, it is, I believe, our duty diplomatically, politically, economically, and as a last resort militarily to help the involved states craft a way out of this mess.
Well, General Eaton, thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back. This has been What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch.